Ms. Odom.
Thank you, Judge Newman, and may it please the court. I'm Amy Odom. I represent Mrs. Kennedy. The Veterans Court erred on page 12 of the appendix when it held that nothing in the law established the delegation of authority to issue fast letter with a liberalizing law from the Secretary to the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services. Section 2.6 and the presumption of regularity are the two laws that establish this delegation of authority. This was a legal error, misinterpretation of 2.6, coupled with reliance on an erroneous rule of law. The misinterpretation of 2.6 lies in the Veterans Court's holding that only the principal deputy undersecretary for benefits could give the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Service the authority to issue the fast letter. That's simply not true. The undersecretary of benefits can bypass the principal deputy undersecretary of benefits and authorize the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services directly to issue a rule like we see in the fast letter.
Are you maintaining your argument about the meaning of a VA issue, whether a VA issue has to be binding on the VA?
Yes, Your Honor. There were two errors of law here. The first was what the parties principally dispute, which is whether the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services had delegated authority to issue the fast letter. The second error of law was the Veterans Court's interpretation of 3.114A, the term issue, to mean only rules that are binding on the agency as a whole, including the board. I can start with that error if that's what the court is principally interested in.
Please do talk about it.
Section 3.114A aims to cover, to remedy the unfairness that arises when the VA is unable to grant a benefit due to under the current laws, and a new rule is issued that then allows the VA to issue the grant the benefit. And that's exactly what happened here. So whether the unfairness arises doesn't depend on whether the rule is binding on the board or other parts of the VA. It's really whether it's binding on the line adjudicators, the adjudicators who make the determination in the first instance. And here there's no dispute that it was.
Counsel, is your interpretation of VA issue that you just mentioned consistent with what you said to the Veterans Court? I thought there was some inherent inconsistency here.
Well, yes, Your Honor. We argued to the Veterans Court in supplemental briefing after the oral argument that a VA issue is something that has to be binding. We never suggested that it had to be binding on the board or in the agency as a whole. What we meant by binding means it couldn't just be like a memo from an RO adjudicator to his buddies saying this is how I think we should decide the cases. It has to come from a place of apparent authority. There's no real dispute here that the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Service, the head of the part of the VA that's responsible for administering the DIC department, had apparent authority to issue guidance and rules to the rest of the adjudicators on the front line. That's exactly what they've done here with this rule. And in fact, taking a step back and looking at the big picture here, VA continues to follow this rule this day. They've incorporated it into the M21, the VA Adjudication Procedures Manual. The current director, 6 months after the Veterans Court decision here, made clear that she did so at the undersecretary's direction. And like this, the Veterans Court found, approved by the secretary part of 3.114 can be established through delegations of authority. And so when the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Service said in the M21, I'm doing this at the undersecretary's direction, that in itself shows that VA has continued to follow the rule, that it's an authoritative rule, and that it's exactly the kind of rule that 3.114A is aimed at.
How would you have us interpret the phrase VA issue?
VA issues any directive. It's a rule of general applicability.
So it need not be binding?
It need not be binding on the whole of VA. It does need to be binding on VBA adjudicators, which it is today. It's just like the M21. The NOVA case says that.
Did you argue that below? I'm having a hard time because honestly, I looked at your brief and you have several different iterations of how to interpret it. binding on the board, binding on the relevant part of the VA. And there's some, like, some that just say doesn't have to be binding, and then there's, and your papers below just say binding on the VA. I'm just struggling a little bit.
Well, by binding with the VA, perhaps it was an inartful way to say it has to be binding on the VA adjudicators. We know already that certain guidance documents, such as the M21, are not binding on the board. They're not binding on the whole VA. But they are binding on the line adjudicators. And so in NOVA, this court explained that their rules of general applicability in that they control the outcome of the adjudication of a claim. And here there's no dispute, and in fact the record demonstrates clearly that the fast letter rule controlled the outcome of the adjudication of this claim. Mrs. Kennedy was denied 3 times before the issuance of this fast letter. And then based on the fast letter, VA granted the claim the 4th time. This is true even though there was even a negative nexus opinion in the record during the prior denials. And NOVA came out after the supplemental briefings here, which made clear that even if a rule isn't binding on the board, it may still be an authoritative rule in that it's a rule of general applicability that controls the outcome of an adjudication of a claim. So as we explained on page 15 of our reply brief, it was the Veterans Court who added that extra step that it also has to be binding on the board. And that's inconsistent even with VA's own regulations, which provide that VA issues are not binding on the board. So under that logic, there could never be a VA issue that would qualify under 3.114A because no VA issues are ever binding on the board.
Okay, but for this case, is it correct that what you're asking for, the only relief you're now asking for, is 1 year retroactivity?
Right. We're asking for application of 3.114A so that Mrs. Kennedy gets that extra year of benefits.
And so there is no relevance to the previous petitions and denials.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
There is much in the record before us as to the procedures that got us to this stage. But now to understand what is, in fact, before this court, it's the 1 year.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I mentioned the prior denials to show that this rule was something that really did affect the outcome of the adjudication of this claim in all DIC claims.
You're relying on the prior denials as support for retroactivity?
The prior denials show that this fast letter, which the VA conceded is the only reason why they granted the claim, was in fact a rule of general applicability that dictated the outcome of the adjudication of this claim. It's not something that was, you know, a memo from, like I said, one RO adjudicator to another suggesting how we might be able to adjudicate these claims. It was an authoritative directive from the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services that controlled the outcome of the claim.
Did you at any point try to let the Veterans Court understand that when you were saying binding on the VA, you only meant binding on the VA adjudicators?
Well, we argued, I don't have the full supplemental brief before me, but we did argue.
It's in the appendix.
Yeah, there's partial of our supplemental briefs. And we did argue that the general counsel opinion saying that M21 provisions are not binding was actually incorrect because they do come from the direction of the Undersecretary for Benefits, and that therefore any determination that the fast letter couldn't count as an issue under 3.114 because it was not binding on the board was incorrect. We did argue below that it was
That's a different argument though, right? I mean, it's different because there you're arguing, no, this is binding on the board.
Well, we did argue that it could be an instruction of the secretary under 7104, the FAST letter, and the M21. But like I said, after the supplemental briefs came out, I think only like 2 days before the Veterans Court's decision came out, NOVA came out that said that in even though it's not binding on the board, a rule can be determinative of the adjudication of the claim. And so when we're looking at 3.114, that's really what counts, is whether the rule dictates the outcome of the claim, not whether it's binding on the board or whether it's binding on other parts of the VA, for example, the Veterans Health Administration. The way that the Veterans Court's rule and interpretation of 3.114 goes, the logical conclusion is that it's not a VA issue under 3.114 unless it's binding on the Veterans Health Administration. It's got to be binding on the agency as a whole. But why would a rule about retroactive benefits have anything to do with the Veterans Health Administration? We also...
Can you explain to me why NOVA would impact the meaning of VA issue here?
NOVA impacts the meaning of VA issue insofar as it defines what a rule of general applicability is and how it affects VA adjudication. So NOVA made clear that it does not have to be binding on the board to actually affect a veteran's or a claimant's substantive rights and dictate the outcome of a claim. And that, again, is what 3.114A is concerned with. Rules that the agency issues, whether formally or informally, that dictate the outcome of a claim. And whether it's binding on the board or not has no impact on whether it's going to dictate the outcome of a claim, because it's binding on the RO adjudicators. We also did point in our brief to many instances in which the board itself has applied the rule, noting explicitly that even though it wasn't binding on it, the board itself, it was binding on RO adjudicators, so the board then felt compelled to apply it.
If we find that your challenge to the Veterans Court's interpretation of VA issue fails, could you still prevail in this appeal?
I think that if we can prevail on the delegated authority issue, we can still prevail, because if we're correct that this rule was issued at the Secretary's approval, then it's necessarily binding to the extent that it needs to be. The Secretary, RO adjudicators and other employees of the VA must follow the Secretary's directions. And so if the Secretary through the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services has approved this rule, I don't see how someone can say that it's not an issue, a VA issue that...
Because it's binding on the VA?
Because it's binding on the adjudicators.
Well, that's presuming that we agree with you on that issue, right? Or that's presuming that you are successful on the meaning of issue, as you've argued before this court.
It's presuming that we prevail on the delegation issue, because otherwise the court would be saying, even though this was issued at the Secretary's direction, it's not a VA issue because it's not binding on anybody. But we think that the binding rule itself is incorrect. The binding interpretation, the interpretation of 3.114A, that it has to be binding on the agency as a whole is incorrect.
If we agree with the government that judicially is stopped from making the argument about what an issue is, because below you argued that the issue had to be binding on the VA, then do you have other arguments that would allow you to succeed on appeal?
Well, again, I lean back on, I can't see how something that comes from the Secretary or approved by the Secretary isn't something that 3.114 speaks directly to. But, and again, I would say that we did not argue that it has to be binding on the agency as a whole. We argue that it has to be binding on VA, meaning it can't just be some informal memo coming from adjudicator. It has to be an authoritative document, which is what this was. And I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Anything else? Good. Thank you. Okay. Okay, we can see you. Can you see us all right, Mrs. Fomenkova?
I can see your honors. Yes, thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, all right. Ms. Fomenkova for the secretary. Please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. In this case, the Veterans Court agreed with Mrs. Kennedy on the legal question, the interpretation of what 3.114 requires in order to have a VA issue approved by or directed by the secretary. Where the Veterans Court disagreed with Mrs. Kennedy is on the application of that interpretation to this fast letter at issue. And that question fundamentally is beyond the scope of this court's review. The court reviews legal interpretations. It does not review the application of that interpretation to the facts. And I want to address the question that was addressed with Ms. Odom as to whether or not she argued below that it needed to be binding. She absolutely did. And we see that at appendix pages 79, 83, and 87. She argued that it had to be directive from or approved by the secretary and is binding on VA, period, and specifically argued that it was binding on the board because it was an instruction to the secretary on appendix page 83, and again on appendix page 87. Whether she sort of subjectively intended that to be a more limited argument, I think the objective evidence.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to catch up with you. Did you say on page 883?
83, yes.
And what can you identify, maybe just a little slower, where you're looking at on that page?
Yeah, it's the first the paragraph that starts on page appendix 83. It says further under 38 USD section 7104C, fast letter 1304 is binding on the board because it is an instruction of the secretary.
Thank you. And
again, the same argument is repeated on page 87 of the appendix. At the very top of that page, she argues an instruction from the secretary that was substantive in nature, the board was bound by it. So I think there's no question.
So it's your view then that because of, when it was suggested that binding on the board means something, binding on the VA means something less than binding on the board, that a person reading this brief would not understand that given these two sentences that you've given us at page 883 and 887?
I think that's right. I think that the objective interpretation of the briefing below is that she argued that it was binding on the board, and certainly the Veterans Court that's how the Veterans Court understood her argument, and explicitly on appendix page 9 said that it was adopting her interpretation on the legal question. The Veterans Court said, we agree with the appellant's narrower definition of the term VA issue. However, we disagree with her application of that definition to FAST letter 1304. And I want to talk a little bit sort of specifically on her argument that I think collapses authority into approval here. Her argument is that sort of establishes a binary, that either something is ultra vires and unauthorized, or it is necessarily approved by the secretary. And this regulation and VA FAST is...
If we agree to affirm, can we do it without reaching whether the FAST letter was issued with the approval of the secretary? Do we need to reach that issue?
Your Honor, I think no. I think we argued that was sufficient and the court doesn't need to reach the binding question. But I think conversely, if the court agrees that Mrs. Kennedy has waived the sort of suggestion that it need not be binding on the entire VA, then that is also a separate and independent reason why it can be affirmed. And so I think sort of either prong is an independent lever that can lead this court to affirm the Veterans Court decision below. So She'd have to prevail on both in order to prevail. We only have to prevail on one in order to prevail.
What's your interpretation of VA issue? I just want to get that out for completeness.
So the VA issue is, I think it's the same definition that the Secretary offered below, and the Veterans Court identifies on appendix page 8. It's any document issued from VA, its administrations, or other staff offices. And the point that I was getting to is that VA, its practice, is it recognizes the possibility that you can have VA issues that have been approved by the Secretary and other VA issues that have not been approved by the Secretary. And that's why the language in this regulation is meaningful, that it identifies that you have to have a VA issue, but that VA issue has to also be approved by the Secretary. And so Mrs. Kennedy's arguments about authority and that sort of presumption of regularity means that this was a VA issue. It was not issued by the director as an ultra-virus action. It wasn't a John Smith issue. It was a VA issue. But it requires also approval by the Secretary. And we see this.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that? It requires also. I didn't.
Approval by the Secretary. But the regulation says that it must be a VA issue that is approved by the Secretary or at the Secretary's direction. And we see this distinction not only in this regulation, but for example in the manual provisions. The manual provisions are VA issues, but they're VA issues that have not been approved by the Secretary. Historically, there have been other manuals that had some provisions that were approved by the Secretary. That's identified in the VA General Counsel opinion that we cite on pages 21 and 22 of our brief. It specifically draws this distinction. The VA used to have a general administrative manual that had a chapter that specifically had provisions that were approved by the Secretary, and it clearly designated those. I mean, when the Secretary approves something, it's not hidden. The VA has no incentive to sort of play coy about that. It's sort of clearly indicated on the face of the document that this is a VA issue that is not only authorized, but also specifically approved by the Secretary. And so, in this case, the fact that it's a VA issue means that Mrs. Kennedy did get these DIC benefits, and we're not disputing that she's allowed and entitled to those DIC benefits now, in part as a result of the procedures that were in this FAST letter. But in order to get a retroactive effective date, that regulation requires that it not only be a VA issue, but that VA issue be approved by the Secretary. And that's the piece that the Veterans Court found was missing here. And sort of the regulations that Mrs. Kennedy points to on appeal, Section 2.6, that doesn't establish that approval. And the presumption of regularity does not establish that approval. That establishes that it's a VA issue, but not that it's a VA issue that was approved by the Secretary. And I want to note sort of two other things in particular based on her argument today. She referenced apparent authority a couple of times. That's not a thing in the government. The government doesn't operate in a world of apparent authority. The government operates in a world of actual authority. And so I think it's telling that her argument is based on apparent authority, because that's just not a thing that exists when we talk about authority in the government. And the second thing I wanted to clarify was her reliance on NOVA. I think NOVA has nothing to do with this case, respectfully. The sort of whether or not a manual provision that hasn't been approved by the Secretary may still nevertheless be subject to direct review in this court under Section 502 is that was what NOVA was answering, and that's a separate question. That review, direct review did not require it to be approved by the Secretary, and this court found that the fact that it wasn't approved by the Secretary was therefore not dispositive. But this regulation plainly does require approval by the Secretary. And so the fact that Mrs. Kennedy recognizes that manual provisions or this past letter, the VA has issues that are not approved by the Secretary, that is the determinative question under this regulation. And so respectfully, NOVA, I think it's, as the Veterans Court correctly held, sort of just tangential to the issues that were raised in this case and the issue that is being interpreted here. So happy to answer any other questions from the court, but I think our bottom line is that, you know, the Veterans Court adopted Mrs. Kennedy's interpretation on the legal question, which is subject to this court's review, and therefore she can't now claim error in sort of that the Veterans Court adopted the thing that she urged them to adopt.
Counsel, are you arguing for a judicial estoppel here? I just want to make sure I have a full, correct understanding of your argument.
I mean, I think that there's sort of a number of prudential doctrines that the court has adopted over the years that amount to this idea that if you were the reason that the lower court adopted this or did this, that you can't then come in and claim error in what you yourself urged the court to do. So I think that sort of to the extent that the court reaches the binding question, Mrs. Kennedy does have a problem with advancing error there, given that it's sort of a direct about face to what she argued below and whether that, you know, we call that judicial estoppel or we call that waiver. I think there are different things that the court can call it that lands in the same place that you just can't do that. But alternatively, that the court could also decide this issue just on the fact that, you know, there's no dispute that the regulation requires this approval, and Mrs. Kennedy doesn't dispute that sort of even before this court. She agreed to that below, and she continues to agree to that here. And the application of that requirement in the regulation that everybody agrees exists, you know, the Veterans Court found was not met here, and frankly, sort of that application of law, her disagreement with that application of law to fact is something that is beyond the scope of this court's review, and that is an independent reason why the court can either dismiss this appeal or affirm the Veterans Court decision below.
Well, I'm still having trouble drawing the line between all of these generalizations and this particular case, that the petition was finally granted. It was identical to the petition that had been denied three previous times. Where should the line be drawn in terms of entitlement?
Your Honor, her entitlement is that she is entitled to DIC benefits, and she has those, and there's no dispute that she will continue to receive DIC.
Well, entitlement is decided, yes, you're entitled. I'm just looking at the date from which the applications of entitlement are measured. Why shouldn't it go back to the petitions that were initially denied before the FAST letter?
So we do not go back to those petitions, Your Honor, and I don't think Mrs. Kennedy is arguing that we do. Those became final. Those previous claims, she did not appeal them, and so they became final. And so the rule, general rule at VA, and by statute, is that your effective date is the date that you submit your new claim, and that's the effective date that she currently has. In order to get this retroactive effective date, that's the exception to that rule, you have to have, you know, a liberalizing VA issue that is approved by the secretary. And so that's the piece that she doesn't have. So she gets DIC benefits. It was an authorized FAST letter. What she doesn't get is the exception to the effective date rule in order to get this retroactive effective date, because this FAST letter was not approved by the secretary as that exception requires.
Yes, no, I agree. That is a very simple, straightforward answer. And meanwhile, we have all of these elaborate procedures ending up here, discussing all sorts of aspects that don't apply to Mrs. Kennedy, and to look for the principles that the VA is establishing, or the position that was taken, it's hard for me to see where the line would be drawn as a generalization, as opposed to this particular case.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I fully understand the court's question, but so I'll try to answer it this way, and you'll let me know if I don't address it. I think the line is that you have to have approval by the secretary. It has to be a VA issue that is approved by the secretary. And the VA sort of recognizes these, that some VA issues are approved by the secretary and other VA issues are not. And so if you have a VA issue that has been approved by the secretary, then that might allow you to get a retroactive effective date. But if you don't have a VA, if your VA issue is not one that has been approved by the secretary, then you can't get a retroactive effective date as a result. I think that's the general principle.
Any more questions? Any more questions? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Oden.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the government has conceded that this was a VA issue. That's what they said below as well. As we argued in our brief, that they were entitled to deference on that particular determination, but the Veterans Court never even addressed it. It just went on and made its own interpretation of 3.114A. So really the principal dispute between the parties here at the Federal Circuit is whether it was approved by the Secretary. We agree with the Veterans Court's holding that approved by the Secretary can be made through a delegation of authority. And then we, as we argued below, that delegation of authority is established here through 2 points, through the statute giving the Secretary the ability to delegate to the Undersecretary of Benefits. Then there's 2.6 where the secretary does just that and delegates all matters relating to veterans benefits to the Undersecretary of Benefits and permitting the Undersecretary of Benefits to then redelegate that authority to any supervisory or adjudicatory employee. Then we look at the functional manual and we see that the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services is in charge of administering the DIC program, and it's the director who signed this FAST letter. The presumption of regularity then steps in to presume that what appears regular is regular. The Supreme Court has held that when something appears regular and somebody does something in their official capacity, the law will presume that all acts that were necessary to give that person the authority have been done. The government hasn't offered any proof that the director did not have authority or delegated authority to issue this rule. The Veterans Court pointed to nothing showing that the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services did not have authority to issue this rule. And in fact, the VA continues to apply it, has put it into the M21, and contrary to the government's position, has stated that the director did it at the undersecretary's for benefits direction. Under 2.6, that means it was done with the secretary's approval, according to the Veterans Court's holding that the approval can come from delegated authority. That's also at page 9 of the appendix.
So if I agree with you, would you have any relief any different from what you've obtained now?
Yes, Your Honor. We would then get a remand for the Veterans Court to apply Ortiz and determine whether the rule was liberalizing. And if it is, then Mrs. Kennedy isn't entitled to an additional year of retroactive benefits under 3.114A.
Still the 1 year.
1 year, Your Honor.
Which would then take us again to the issue that really just skirted about all of the rules about entitlement to benefits run from the date of application.
Now, under 5110G and 3.114A, there's an exception to that rule when the benefit has been granted based on a liberalizing VA issue. And so this case, if we are correct on the approval by the secretary and that it's liberalizing under the Ortiz standard, then Mrs. Kennedy would have the benefit of that exception and get an additional year of benefit.
Okay, but still, that's a somewhat different question. is it not?
Well, I think that the Veterans Court's decision was on the elements of 3.114A. And so now we are now we're appealing the Veterans Court that the approved by the Secretary element could not be met here because the principal Undersecretary of Benefits did not give the Director of Pension and Fiduciary Services delegated authority. That's a misinterpretation of 2.6, and it ignores the presumption of administrative regularity.
Okay. Any more questions?
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thanks to counsel on both sides. The case is taken under submission.